we're in verse 15, Satdarshana. Okay. Satdarshana. Satyas chidatma vibhida kritis chit. Satyas chidatma vibhida kritis chit. Siddhyet pratak satya chato na bhinna. Siddhyet pratak satya chato na bhinna. Bhusha vikara kinusanti satyam. Bhusha vikara kinusanti satyam. Vina suvaranam pratagatra loke. Vina suvaranam pratagatra loke. Satyaha chit atma. Satyaha chit atma. Vivida, vivida akriti chit, or vivida kritis chit. Either way, akriti I think is better. Vivida akritis chit, siddhyet pratak satya, satya chito napinna. Bhusha vikaraha kimusant kim u, so bhusha vikaraha. Kim u santi satyam vina suvarnam pratak atra loke. Here. Satyaha chiratma. The atma, the self, which is consciousness. So really the self, which is pure consciousness. The pratyagatma, the innermost self, the atma, the self. Which is consciousness, the chidatma, is satyam. That is real. Yourself, the conscious being that you are, is satyam. That is the truth. That is real. Vivida kritihi chit. The consciousness, the chit, which is in all of these various forms. Vivida means various forms, right? All of vivida, multi... various is good. Divida akriti. All of these various forms are also consciousness. Right? So we have the consciousness which is the self and the consciousness which is all of this, all of these various forms, he says. This divida akriti chit siddhyet pratak satya chittaha nibinna, he says. This consciousness in all of this variety of forms, nabhinna, cannot be divided or separated from the satyachit, the consciousness which is real. So that satyachit is in the fifth case for Sanskrit people. Nabhinna. So the consciousness that appears in all of these various forms can't be separated from, can't be divided from or separated from the consciousness which is the consciousness, the real consciousness, siddhyet. That can't be accomplished. That can't happen. We can't make that type of division. It can't be divided or separated from, and it can't be pratak. It can't exist separately. Pratak means to be separate. So you can't divide that. You can't say that there's two things here where they're existing separately. They can't be existing separately, and they can't be removed or divided from consciousness itself, the consciousness which is real. So he gives an example to try to make clear what he's talking about. Okay, so he says, Bhusha vikaraha, all of the modifications, the vikaras, that are ornaments, vikaras in the form of ornaments, he says, kim u santi satyam. Can they have any satyam, any reality, vina suvarnam, without gold? If you imagine all these gold ornaments, do these gold ornaments have any reality apart from gold? Pratak. Can they exist separately? Do they have any separate being apart from the gold? Gold, all of the modifications that the akriti and the vikara here are used in the same way. All of these modifications of gold in the form of all hundreds of ornaments, all different varieties of ornaments. Do all of these ornaments have any existence, any reality apart from the gold? Here in the world. So he says, here, atra, loke, here in this world, you see all of these golden ornaments. Do all of these ornaments have any being any reality, any satyam, any existence apart from the gold. Like that, all of these modifications that we experience in the world, these themselves, like we would say with the gold ornaments, this gold ornament exists, this ornament exists, this ornament exists. Right? All of these ornaments exist. But do they have any existence that is separate from the gold? So like that, in this creation we say, all of these things, it is. There in that example would be, it is gold, 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 gold. Here we would say, in this creation, it is. Everything, it is. But does this world that you experience, is its being, is its existence, does it have any separate being apart from yourself? Does it have a being which is, belongs to it? Does the being that enjoys, it is, does that isness belong to it, separate, pratak, separate from the being that is you? So say, for instance, and this is really, it's the whole Advaita, that's why I was talking a little bit about Asanga. If I say, I am Asanga, myself, just think of all of the things that you say about this, about the self when we're doing kind of a viveka, a seer-seeing differentiation. I recognize, you know, that my body changes, it comes in, takes birth, it goes through its life, and then it dies. My thoughts are one thought after another thought after another thought after another thought. They come into my experience, they go out of my experience. I differentiate myself from my thoughts. I differentiate myself from my experiences, right? And that, in doing that differentiation, I'm able to recognize that myself is really free from those experiences. And therefore, abiding amidst, in and through, and is the very warp and woof of all the experiences that I have, I am there, but I am there as a changeless presence. Because my being isn't doing anything. It's not apart from my experiences, because I can't have an experience away from my presence. So I can't have an experience that's over there and I'm over here. You know, as though there's some separation. I can't make a separation from my experience, but I can recognize that my experience doesn't touch me. Right? So I realize that in reference to all of my experience, I am Asanga. Asanga means I'm not attached. If I were attached to it, the experiences of experience came and left, then when it left, I would be going with it. Right? Or if experience was one thing and I am attached to that thing, when that experience changes, then I'm gone. Right? Because I had a real relationship. Asanga means an attachment, you know, to the thing that I was experiencing. But what if there is no attachment? All the experiences come and go and you remain the same. If you notice that, then you can say, I am Asanga in reference to those experiences. And so that's what we have to kind of recognize. Then, okay, I'm the Asanga Atma. You know, I'm the Atma which is ever free, ever unattached. But then, what is the Asanga Atma, the self that I am, what is my relationship then to this, to these things that I'm unattached to? That's two. Here I am, the Asanga Atma, that is not touched by any experience that I have, that remains pervasive to, but ever untouched. Then I am related to that thing which I am not attached to. You see what I mean? There's something that I'm not attached to. So there's myself that is free of this too. And so that's the thing, like with Vedanta, you can't stop at this Asanga Atma. Because in the end, there's only Atma. In the end of your understanding, in the end, it's not Asanga Atma, as though there's something to be not attached to. There's only the self. There's only the Atma. That's Advaita. That's why we say the whole teaching is the Atma is Brahman. Your self is limitless. It's Brahman. Brahman means that it's infinite. Your self is infinite. You can't have infinite plus one. You say, oh, I thought Brahman was infinite. I thought the self was infinite. And now there's this creation. It's not infinite then. Right? How can it be infinite? The self is infinite, and then there's this creation also. But that creation is going to be another, the other. So if your self is not the creation, or is not your experience, right? That's dvaita. You see the problem there? It's not really a problem. You have to understand it. That's all. Like, say if you have the wave ocean analogy that we use, you know? We can say advaita. The only thing there is water. That's all. All of the waves and the ocean that we say is the whole body of all of the waves, all of the dvaita, all of the duality, you know, put together and it's complete in its wholeness, you know, all of that we say is mitya. All of the waves and the totality of waves that we would call Ishwara, the ocean, you know, all of that is mitya. Why do we say mitya? What does that actually mean? It means that we totally acknowledge all of the waves. We totally acknowledge the ocean that is the totality of all of the waves. Yes, all of those are there. But what is their relationship to the water? What is the relationship to the water? Is there water plus the waves? Would we say that the water is a sangha? So say the wave is meditating. Yeah, it says, I am the Asanga water. I am the Asanga water. No? It's a legitimate meditation because the reason the meditation, as false as it is, is legitimate because when you're gaining knowledge, you're starting from the standpoint of the jiva. What is a person? A person doesn't start realizing, you know, I am Brahman, or even I am Ishvara. It starts with the conscious being being identified, the conscious being that you are, the conscious me, being totally identified with this physical body and mind and sense organs. And so the jiva, the individual, starts with this, I am this physical body. I am this what we call karya karana sangata. I am this body-mind complex. That's who I am. I, the conscious being, am this body-mind complex. That's what makes me a person. A conscious being is all of this. You know? So I exist because this body exists. I am conscious because I have a living body. And so the living body is responsible for isness, my sense of being, and it is responsible for my consciousness, this living body. Because I don't identify with a dead body. I mean, a dead body isn't a conscious body. So it's this body that is, and this body that is conscious. And so this is where we start. You know, there's a what we call anyonya adhyasa. There's a mutual superimposition. You know, when somebody comes to the teacher, and then in all the Upanishads, the student will come to the teacher, and the question is always something like, please tell me who I am. You know, and so, is there anything about me that survives death? Is there anything about me that is free of dharma and adharma? Free of the opposites? Who am I? Who is this person here? You know, am I really just this body or mind or sense organs? I don't know. Please teach me. That's what the student will always come to the teacher with, it, some sort of question like that. And so here, starting with myself as a jiva in this creation, as a person within this creation, I am going to be taken on a journey that will take me to a completely opposite and a very, very different understanding of myself. Instead of being identified as a time-bound mortal subject to birth and death in this creation, different from you and you and you, and certainly different from the whole, I have to travel in my knowledge, in terms of my knowledge, from that position of total limitation to a recognition that I am the whole. It's not to a recognition that I am the sangha, a sangha atma. That's not it. That's just the beginning. The recognition of the I am a sangha atma, I am a self which is free and unattached to all the experiences I'm having, right? that, in a sense, that brings me initially to Dvaita, where I am now able to differentiate myself from my experiences and recognize that, in fact, my being is not touched by my experiences, that I am stable and I am constant, and I, in fact, am free from all of the things that I can objectify. All of my experiences, whether it be the experiences of my mind, my moods, my emotions, you know, my physical body, or all of my perceptions, all of the things that go on in my world, in my perceptual world, all of those things on every level have no ability to touch me, my being, in any way. So with that, that's a huge understanding. Just that is a huge understanding, because there's a constant. I recognize myself as a constant being that can't be hurt. My own mind, with all of its pains, can't hurt me or take that away from me. In fact, as I become more mature in my knowledge, my own presence is able to hold all of the things that are going on within duality and within my own mind and heart. All of that takes place within the silent presence and benign presence of myself. That's a huge freedom. And so, but in that, and on that level, I can say, I am a Sangha. My being is a Sangha. It's Ananda. It is whole and complete. It can't be diminished in any way. So it is Ananda, Anandoham. I am whole, I am full, I am complete. My being is Ananda, is whole. And it is Asanga. It can't be touched. And it is Nitya. It is free from time. It is timeless. So I recognize that in the midst of all of the chaos of Dvaita, of duality, inner and outer duality, in all of that chaos, there is a changeless presence, which is me. That's a wonderful recognition. But then, what is all of this? You know, how do I need to, with that knowledge, you know, like, if I say, okay, I am a Sangha Atma, so let's just forget all of this. In fact, here, let's just, let's practice Nididhyasana. Mm. Let's just practice meditation, you know, as much as we possibly can in a mosquito-free environment, you know, where it's not too cold, not too warm, where nothing's going to disturb me, and I can just kind of pull away, you know, from this samsara, you know. So am I going to remain as a Sangha Atma, you know, in the midst of this samsara? What do I do with this, you know? And so that's why, you know, what Ramana is stressing here, and what also Swamiji will stress so much. In the end, that's really not enough. In the end, because what are you going to do with this jiva, with this body, mind, sense organs in this world? You know, what do you do with it? You know? How do you negotiate the ever-changing sukha and dukkha of the world? Means you can say, some people can have the idea that, well, you know, if I could just get knowledge and become an enlightened person, we just have knowledge and become enlightened. Now, I mean really enlightened. The real thing, okay. The real enlightenment. Then the sukha and dukkha, you know, the sukha means the pleasurable experiences in the world that they are meant to give me pleasure. And we say the Prarabdha karma is 50-50. It provides sukha and it provides dukkha. Means it's providing, it can't really give you sukha and dukkha, but it can give you experiences that are unpleasant, hard, difficult, not meant to make you happy. And it can give you other experiences where you think, wow, this proves that Ishwara really is there. Bhagavan really exists, because this great synchronicity has happened and it's benign, and so Bhagavan is there and is taking care of me, and it just my shraddha has increased a hundredfold. because Bhagavan has shown his true colors. I love you, and here's a big present for you. But you know what? Life isn't like that. We can think, when I become truly enlightened, the dukkha is all going to go away. You know, everything's going to become tailor-made for you. Tailor-made for you. Because you are now an enlightened being. You are an enlightened being. That's as high as you can go on the scale. You have reached the pinnacle of being an enlightened being here on this loka. You know? This loka, which is 50-50 sukha and dukkha, but somehow you've transgressed it. No, it does not happen. Does not happen. But what if you think that does happen? What if you have a feeling or a belief or a notion that that does happen? Right? That's going to be what we call an obstruction. You know? That's what we call pratibandhika. It's going to be a pratibandhika. It's a big pratibandhika. Big obstruction to your understanding, because you'll always be waiting, you know, for the creation to all of a sudden, you know, make everything fine for you. And it doesn't. It doesn't. It just throws one boulder after another. The only thing that makes the boulders that are coming, you know, the obstructions and the difficulties and the things that you wouldn't have wished for, you know, all right, is that on one level, I'll get to Ishwara in a minute, on one level, in spite of whatever is happening, your being, the ananda of yourself, is untouched. It is asanga. That is never touched. And so now the question is, what is your mind? How does your mind hold the experience of sukha and dukkha that is continuing to come your way? Are you... Let me say it like this. What do you expect out of the creation? What do you expect out of Ishwara? It's a big question. It's very important, actually. What do you, as a jiva, within the whole, you know, part to the whole, you're a jiva within Ishwara, a part to the whole, what do you expect? Like, for instance, let's just go to the extreme. Do you expect that if things were going well, that this body would live to an old age, very old age, never get sick along the way, and then you would die in your sleep? See what I mean? Or do you think that actually there would be no death? Or that do you think there would be no disease? Or do you think that there would be no divorce? I mean, you could go on and on and on. What do you think there wouldn't be? Do you think there would be no earthquakes? Do you think there would be no arguments? Yeah. Do you think there would be no pain in your relationships? What do you think? See, if we go down the list like that, everybody would probably go, no, I don't think that. No, I know that one. That's not going to happen. This can get more involved. Do you think that your parents would have, if all was well, your parents would have treated you right when you were growing up? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think there'd be no war? You know. Think there'd be no abuse? You just start thinking, can we really start eliminating all of these things? And then what would the opposite be? I think that, you know, all parents would really love their children. All parents would really love their children. All nations would get together. Everybody would be a vegetarian. All people would be vegetarian. You know? There would be no such thing as animal cruelty. People wouldn't steal from each other. You know? And we could just go down that list. And all the while, as you go down this list, and either way that you go, you would probably say, no, I don't really think that. Right? You just, no, I don't really think that. That's not realistic. And then would you say, I know that's not the way it is, that there is sukha and dukkha in the world. These opposites exist throughout on every level. These opposites exist to the extreme in any degree, right? But then you can start saying, well, that's true. In this creation, from the most horrid to the most sublime, everything along the way exists. And then you can say, so here it is. Why am I here and not here? So, why am I here when so-and-so is here? On this scale, you know, so-and-so has having these experiences, but I'm having these experiences. I don't think that's fair, that so-and-so is having these experiences, but so-and-so's, but I'm having these experiences. These experiences are much worse than so-and-so's experience. Now, something interesting to start thinking, because we have to shift our way of understanding our position in the world here. What if you think like this? In this infinite creation, so we say the creation is infinite, and say you look at it like this, the scale from heaven to hell in terms of experience is infinite. That there's no limit, it's infinite. So you think like that. Now you're here, here's this infinite experience, infinite scale, and here you are on it. Here you are. Now, how many people, if it's an infinite scale, have it worse than you do? And how many people have it better than you? Now, say if you say, here's the scale, this is bad, this is good, and you're here. Infinite, have it worse. Infinite, have it better. Say you're here. Infinite, have it worse. Infinite, have it better. So how are you going to win? That's the thing. That's when you think, you know, people who are, say, really wealthy. How many people are wealthier? How many people are poorer? You know, somebody's healthy. How many people are healthier? How many people are not? So everything in this world of duality, you know, has to do with the attainment of sukha. That's what we know. The attainment of sukha means what? At those moments when I feel all is well with me, those moments when, in fact, I'm free of that scale, for those moments I'm free of that sukha and dukkha, I'm free of the scale completely. Right? How to be free of the scale? Can I be in this experience and free of the scale? Can I be totally involved in the world? Totally involved with my emotions? Totally involved with my set of experience? If my totally involved, engaged in my set, my own personal set of experiences, and whole and complete? Can I be sitting here in the midst of my life and say, Anandoham, I am full and complete? Can I do that? Or is my life, is my ananda only in reference to the experiences I'm having? That's the difference really between being free, you know, and being bound. Can I be in this universe, in my life, and be free? Or does my life have to be in a particular way in order to be free, to be whole? And that's the problem. Even to whatever degree, you have to have your experience be in a particular way, to that degree you're not free. Because even if you were to get your experience the way you wanted it, the experience would go on changing. See what I mean? You can't stop the creation, so you're just going to have a snapshot of, ah, this is how I want it. Please don't move. Yeah. This is perfect. Oh, no. You know, how can I stop it from changing? This is exactly how it's supposed to be. How can I hold that? That's a tremendous stress. That is so stressful. You know, but when that's the situation, and that is the situation of samsara, how to be free of it? How to be free of the samsara while I'm still completely in it? That's the thing. Can I be free of samsara while I'm completely in it? And so then then it comes down to understanding what my relationship is, the relationship of myself to the so-called samsara. Is there anything in this creation, anything at all in this creation that has any type of separation from my being? That's the first thing he's wanting, because Roman is going to be going on with this now. It's the first thing he wants you to see. Is there anything in this creation at all, in any level of experience, that is other than me? It's like asking in the wave ocean, is there any wave or any wave relationship that is other than me? And if I say no, then that means, you know, it's, why am I choosing one wave over another? Why am I choosing one experience over another? What is it that the wave has to offer me that is other than the water? So what am I looking for? That's the thing that has to be understood. So here when he says, you know, in this experience, there is a chit, a consciousness, a being, which is real. There is something which is real. There is something which is continually changing, which is not separate from that consciousness. But that things, those things that are continually changing, they have no being separate from what is actually there. And so here, when I'm looking at my experience, this is the viveka that you kind of have to walk around seeing over and over again, is that in this experience, if I'm looking, for instance, just at this room, that there is one common denominator here in the totality of your experiences. You're looking at the room through all of your sense, experiencing the room through all of your sense organs. There's one common denominator. We can say it in two ways, but there's really only one. You can't say, like, there's really a relationship between the table and the desk and the chair. These are all individual items that we use. But what is the same that the between the table and the desk and the chair and me and the space and the rug and you? What is the common denominator? What's the common denominator between me, a conscious being, and the table? So now, to do that, you have to go to a level in your experience that has nothing to do really with a particular name and form. So in your own personal experience, now you have to see in your experience what is there that is there true, abiding in every perception that you have. And it is there as something that is immediate and obvious to you. It's immediate and obvious to you. And I would say like this. We can do it in two ways. We can say, I am. I exist. I recognize my own existence. We can say that. That should be immediate and obvious. That I am an existent being. We're not talking about any funny use of words. It's just say, I exist. I'm an existent conscious being. You say. So now I say, I exist, and you exist, and you exist, and you exist. There's a funny use of language there. If I say, I exist, I am, and then I say, you exist, you are. Right? I don't experience two existences. If I say I exist and I just focus on my own existence, and then I say you exist, am I experiencing a separate existence from my own existence? I'm experiencing a different name and form. You see that? You're a different name and form. But the being that I am, when I say I am, is that different from you are? Is the actual experience of existence, does it change? And I would say, you can't ever change the experience of being. Because the experience of being, the being that you are, is not something that you can look at or that you can objectify. It's just something that you are, your own amness. Now, so it's another way to look at this too. Your own consciousness. You say, I am a conscious being. Yeah. The conscious being that you are, can you objectify it? Can you look at it? Can you look at your consciousness? Say no. You just experience, I am a conscious being. But then I see you're a conscious being, and you're a conscious being, and you're a conscious being. We're all conscious beings. But this isn't a conscious being. So can we say that consciousness, we can say the existence is really also, existence is not something I can objectify. Consciousness is not something I can objectify. But consciousness is something that is pervasive to every experience I have also. And existence is pervasive to every experience I have. It is, it is, it is, it is, it is. Consciousness is pervasive to every experience I have too. How is it? It is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. You could say, I'm conscious of it, I'm conscious of it, I'm conscious of it, I'm conscious of it, I'm conscious of it. Even this, I'm conscious of it. The problem with this isn't conscious of me, but I'm conscious of it. So that's another common denominator in all of my experience. All of the experience equally is. All experience equally is known. You can never do anything about it. It doesn't matter whether it's a thought modification, an imagination, a perception. It is known. If the object is not there to be known, then whatever is there is and is known. If nothing is there to be known, then what is there is and is known without an object of knowledge. That's like saying, is and conscious is, which is consciousness, is there without anything, you know, to be known. But what I'm saying is that, say you look at your experience now, it is and it is known. Every experience that you have, any object that you say, it is known. You can get rid of the object, and then the pieces of the object that are left, those things are, they are known. It's an experience that cannot vary. It's the invariable experience. It's an invariable, non-objectifiable experience of your being. And every experience you have, whether it be a positive experience or a negative experience, it is known. As that experience transforms, it is and it is known. You can say, every experience that I have, another language we can use, every experience that I have takes place in my amness. I don't experience isness. I mean, we have to just look at our words. I could say I is or I am using the grammar. I am. That's a direct, immediate self-experience. I am. And then so that I keep the Advaita there, I can say I am, you am, it am. There is nothing that is not am. There's no conversion that you yourself or transformation you go through in your experience for am, are, is. These are all just words that are label the being in which everything takes place. So that being, which is me, well, that's another problem. The being that is me, is the being that is me conscious or not? Is the being, let me put it this way, is the being that is me consciousness or not? If it's not consciousness, then consciousness should be illumining the being that is me. And then there would be a difference between non-objectifiable existence, because I can't look at some existence, I just am, and non-objectifiable consciousness. I can't look at consciousness either. There's some consciousness over there. You know? I am consciousness, and there's some more over there. I exist, and there's some more existence over there. There's no way to objectify consciousness, or my amness. So I say the amness, the being that I am, is consciousness. And now you try to get something away from it. Can you, as a jiva, have any experience at all that has any type of distance at all from the being, from the conscious being that you are? So now we have to go just one more little step, and then I'll do the breath, continue next week. In this world, it's harder for me, even though the experience is exactly the same, really. Let me explain. I'm experiencing you in this room through my sense organs that are creating a thought modification in my mind. That's how it is. If I didn't have my eyes open and my mind was daydreaming, I would just be experiencing my daydream, right? But if my mind is using my eyes, then I'm experiencing my eyes. Because of my eyes, they are giving me a thought modification, a vritti, a thought. You know, a perceptual thought. And that's what I illumine. And so that's how I know. That's how I communicate. But now, because I have a body, and I am also one of the bodies in this room, and my sense organs are in this room, my sense organs in my body in my in this room, I don't really notice, because of the identification is so much with my body, I don't really notice that, in fact, how I'm experiencing this room is simply through a thought modification, which is pervaded by equally by my being and my awareness. That's what you know. We have to account for this duality, because I'm a physical body and you're a physical body. We do have to account for that. But the point is here, what I want to make you understand, is that no matter whether there's a real duality here or not, in terms of your experience, you are experiencing a thought modification that has been provided to you by your sense organs, which is illumined and pervaded by your being, your awareness. That's why you can say, you can actually recognize what I'm saying here, is that in this, you're sitting in this room, all right. But your experience of this room is equally pervaded, fully pervaded by the being that you are and the consciousness that you are. Because what you're actually experiencing is a thought modification. So when I say, it is, and that isness is me, that is in fact the reality of your experience. It is known, and the consciousness that allows that is me. That is the reality of your experience, because all you're really experiencing is a thought modification in your mind. But we don't recognize that fact, because there's so much of a identification with this body, and I take myself to be a jiva in the room. Whereas if I ask you to have an imagination of the room, close your eyes and have an imagination of the room. Whatever you remember, just imagine the room. Then if I were to say, do you recognize that this whole room exists in you? That you are this imaginal room? The whole room exists in you. You are the conscious being, which is the self of the room. You are the existent conscious being, which is really the all-pervading self of the imaginal room. So, yes, certainly. Do you recognize that every object in the imaginal room really has no being apart from you? Oh, absolutely. Can you say, I am the truth of the room, I am the self of the room, and the room has no being apart from me? Oh, yes, absolutely. But it's easy when I, because I've already accepted this as an imagination. I'm imagining the room. But the imaginal room is a vritti. The perceptual room is a vritti. There is no difference in terms of the content of your experience. Vritti, self with vritti, with thought modification, self with imaginal thought modification, self with perceptual thought modification. No difference at all. You know? The problem is, you can't just easily accept that, because the mityatva, or the maya nature of your mind and your dream, your imagination, is already accepted by you. As a samsara, you already accept the mityatva, the apparent nature, the mayatvam, you know, mm-hmm. of your imagination, mm-hmm. of your thoughts, see? But your perceptions in your mind, it's still exactly the same. It's still a thought. But you have the conclusion that this perceptual thought is given to me because of objective reality, right? So it's hard for me to see that the experience I'm having is the same, because one's imaginal reality, pratibhasika, you know, imaginal reality, where this, it's created out of imaginal reality, where this is created out of perceptual reality, and this is an objective world, right? This world is real. But I still want to. We have to get rid of that. That idea. I agree with that. We do have to get rid of that idea. But all I'm trying to make you understand here is that the experience that you're having, whether born of perceptual reality or being born of imaginal reality, both are thought modifications, right? And so, experience-wise, you should be able to say that I experience myself. I can have that viveka, where I recognize myself as the self as of both, the being of both, the self of both. Right? That's an important thing to understand, because the experience is same. It's not that one thought is more real than the other thought. Mm. Both are just thoughts. And so, if you can experience you, the changeless, pervasive nature of yourself in the imaginal thought, then you can equally experience it in the perceptual thought. Hmm. What's left that we have to deal with is the difference between imaginal reality and myself being a physical body in this. This seems more real. Hmm. Just like it would seem more real in your imagination to the character within the imagination. Say you have an imagination of the room, and then all the people are, you imagine all the people in the sitting in the room, and say they're carrying on conversations or listening to class or whatever, and those people aren't going to say, I'm the self of the room, right? Because they're just experiencing, they think the room is real, mm-hmm. right? They're an individual within the room. They're not going to say, I'm the self of the room, right? They're jiva in the room. But then you're going to say, I'm the self of the room. See the difference? So that's just something for the mind to work on a little bit, just so that you can. The point here is, because in the next verse he really addresses, he's going to try to resolve this thing that we call physical reality. Mm. You know? But here, if you can just kind of play with the reality of the experiential reality of what I'm talking about, you know, vritti, vritti. Thought modification, thought modification. If you recognize your pervasion and changelessness in one thought modification, you need to be able to recognize them in every thought modification. Thought modification is thought modification. Whatever level of reality, and whatever the content of the thought modification is, it doesn't make any difference. I'm talking about the relationship of you to the thought modification. Whether it's generated by the physical world or an emotion, imaginal world, doesn't make any difference. You have to see who you are in reference to it. Okay, so we'll do the next verse next time. Stick it in. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishchate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Hari Om.
This is kind of like a cliffhanger because I can illumine the imaginary world, and then I illumine the objective world. But we haven't dealt with how the objective world becomes mithya, where the, like you said, the imagined world is very obvious that it's mithya.
Yeah. So the thing to notice, why to kind of juxtapose those side by side like that, is put them side by side like that, is to see that they're, in fact, that relationship, that satya-mitya relationship, that relate is pervasive. In fact, you can never get away from it because that's the reality. Otherwise, there's no advaita. So that particular reality of the, your pervasive presence to all experience, there is no exception to that. The only exception, if you want to call it an exception, is the resolution of the mithya. You can't resolve the satyam. You can't resolve that which is real.
Mm-hmm.
But the mithya resolves all the time. Right? It's continually changing, coming into being, going out of being, coming into being, going out of being. But the satyam, which is its truth, never comes into being and goes out of being.
Mm-hmm.
And so the relationship between the satyam and mithya, the mithya is ever changing as the creation is ever changing on every level. But you look at it from the standpoint of the jiva, from the standpoint of Ishwar, there's continual movement and change going on. But the truth of it is never not there. Right? So there's something to notice, that once you notice, that's the end of it in terms of your own presence, that your own nature. Because once you recognize it, that will never change. It's the changeless truth of every experience. It can never not be there. Yeah. But there's a lot of things that have to be taken care of in this world in terms of the relationship of the jiva to Ishwara and the jiva yourself to all of these experiences, yourself to your mind. Because we are have a beginningless history of dvaita, not advaita, you know. That means that the mind itself is totally interconnected in a dual way with all the experience that we have. And so that's why this teaching, you know, the teaching of Vedanta or the Upanishad, it doesn't take place just in one day. In a way, we can say you're the self of everything, and do one prakriya, one kind of teaching methodology to make you see it, and everything's fine, and go your way. It's not that way at all. It's because the mind has very deeply rooted conclusions about myself as this individual.
And the mind seems to be dual also.
Oh yeah, it's all dual. But see, the tricky thing is that what is most dear to you, which is Brahman, which is yourself, that is totally identified with you, body. Your sense of self, of me, you know, the me which is in fact Brahman, so when the whole universe goes away, I'm still there, but I don't know that. It's me, what is most dear to me is totally identified with this body-mind sense organs. You know, and so even when this teaching is taking place, it's all nice and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all well and good. But what about me is always the feeling. You know, it's like, it's all fine, it makes sense logically, good. but I don't want to die. You know, what about me? It's a very tricky, very subtle, for the mind all has to recognize that this what about me, that's who we're talking about. That is who we're talking about. This one that is so much me, so intimate, so me, that when you go to the teacher, you know, in all the Upanishads, you go to the teacher and you say, who am I? Do I survive death? What do they mean? They're not talking intellectually, some concept of an Atma. Mm-hmm. They're saying, do I survive death? Do I, that is most dear to me, that makes me me? Does the me that makes me me survive death? Who am I? But the identification of that what is most dear is so much with the body-mind complex that it takes some real teaching and time for the mind to recognize that it's kind of a recognition like, oh, they're honestly talking about me. The me that I take to be me, the me that I take to be me is Brahman. Not some intellectual or philosophical me.
So they're,
then
they're,
that's moksha.
They're not really serious about that then. I mean,
that's the whole thing. Yeah, they're absolutely serious about it. Yeah. It's a big realization. I remember having this realization when I was, actually it was quite early on. You know, sometimes you understand things, you think you really do understand them, but then you really understand them later, and then later you really understand them. So I had one of these real understandings kind of early on when I got to India and I was with Swamiji. He's getting classes in Rishikesh, and I was new, pretty new. It was almost like a vision, and it went like this, something like, oh my God, there really is such a thing as a guru. There is such a thing as moksha, as liberation, and there is such a thing as Ishwar. These are reality. This is real. This is actually real. That was a shocking. I felt it was that was a big moment for me to realize that there was, that it actually wasn't pretend. It wasn't just a notion. You know, that there was actually, that these things were real. There was such a thing as a guru. There was such a thing as knowledge. There was such a thing as liberation. There was such a thing as Ishwara, that it was a reality. That was amazing. But I saw that very clearly. I didn't at that time see what that reality actually was, except to see that it was there. Mm-hmm. That it was there. Mm-hmm. That's, yeah.
And somebody was talking about that.
Yeah. That there's that sampradaya, that tradition of teaching, and they're teaching about something that is there. You know? So shocking. You know, because I think, you know, for most of us, we've had some sort of growing up where had your own spirituality or had some sort of religious nature, spiritual nature. You had shraddha, some sort of shraddha, you know, some sort of faith in God, that there was God and there was something. But it was only shraddha. It wasn't knowing it. You know it, you believe it, you feel it, you know it's true, but you don't really know. There's where you cross a line between knowing it but not really knowing it. You know it, but you don't really know, but you know it. To, you know it. You know that it's true. That's a big thing. That's a big, you know, that's a big jump to make.
Can I ask?
And to break that jump, make that jump from gaining self-knowledge to recognizing that the self they're talking about is you, the you that you take yourself to be. Because you can say things, I used to always joke, Swamiji's joked in one way or another about this, too. Like, you know, it's fine that you can go to heaven or there's liberation, but who cares if I don't go? You know, it's like, okay, there's a heaven, but But who cares if I'm not going to it? That some soul, because there's a division, you know, between your concept of a soul or concept of an Atma. Okay, so the Atma is liberated and timeless, but what about me? If I'm not liberated and free and timeless, then I don't care about that. So there's always this division, mm-hmm. you know, that somehow through the different forms of teaching gets, you know, gets broken, that division disappears, and then you realize, oh, all along they're talking, and they've been talking about me, yeah. not some Atma, not something else, not somebody else, like a subtle plane, a subtle me up there in the stars somewhere or whatever. Terry?
I found you talking about your realization at the ashram very interesting. How did you even find Swamiji as a teacher then? Like, if it wasn't that you...
That happened after he was been teaching, right?
For you. Like,
yeah.
Because for me, it was always... I'm just finding it curious. I'm just curious about how, if you... Like, for me, it was always, I was brought up very fundamentalist Christian. And I was always, like, it was always very bizarre to me because I was just like, this is, I don't, well,
didn't sit well.
Like, it's just, so for me, like, even just the very first class coming here, I was like, oh, thank God I'm not the only one that, like, thinks this way. It's very, so it's fascinating for me, just more in a curiosity, like, how you even were interested in Vedanta.
You know what they say? They say that we all come in with samskaras, you know, mm-hmm. that we bring those type, that certain samskaras or tendency, sometimes they call it a Vedanta Vasana, you know, where the sun, that's one way of talking about, you know, another way of understanding though too, is that if there's enough shanti or peace in the mind to have some type of self-reflection, you are that, mm-hmm. you know. That is who you are. And so you can all probably remember, like, maybe reading a book here or there. I used to open up the Bible to see, to, you know, to try to get it to talk to me and all this kind of stuff. Or in books that you've read, or that something, you know, or just things that you would see, there was something that would just ring true, or a thought that would come would just ring true. Because you are who you are, even if there's a huge veil of ignorance. Mm-hmm. The reality is reality. And so reality is, in a way, yelling at you all the time. I mean, it's in so many ways, you know, it's revealing itself to you, but always incompletely, you know, so that you don't have the whole picture, but it reveals itself to you over and over again, and you always feel like you would intuit the truth of it, even though you wouldn't be able to put all the pieces of the puzzle together, but over and over intuit and feel and see the truth, you know, but not be able to put it all together. Mm-hmm. That's why for many people they'll say when they hear Vedanta, it's as though the teaching is just saying what you already know. Just finally somebody's putting it into words. It's such a huge relief, but it's not foreign, you know. And I think whenever we have an experience, when something is said that actually matches the way things are, you know, then there's a knowing, you know, kind of a relief and a seeing and a feeling like it's, we've all always known it, especially when it's talking about you. You know, it goes to, because it, all the pieces start fitting together. You see it, or feel it, or whatever. Anybody has special experiences that, you know, their journey, your journey to where, to coming to some clarity.
So how can you, like I've noticed lately for myself, because I had gone to a bookstore one time when I was in San Luis Obispo, and I had run across some books, and they had said that they were Vedanta. They seemed like, as I was reading some of them, it's like, well, this seems sort of interesting. And is it just in your, like, for me, with, because there's a particular book I'm reading, and sometimes I catch my mind being very frightened that I'm, like, learning the wrong thing, like something that's not really the truth. And is there anything that I can...
Well, actually...
That fear?
Yeah. I mean, actually, even in the tradition, they talk about that. Because actually, when, say, you come to a teacher, when you come, you don't know. Mm-hmm. The teacher may or may not know, because you don't know. Since you don't know, you can't know if the teacher knows or doesn't know. So that's why they say in the tradition itself, it's Ishwara Anugraha. That's the grace of Ishwara. It's the grace of God. And punya, to get to the proper teaching. And then they also say, then you can say, well, I hope Bhagavan's good.
I hope he's paying attention.
the other thing they say that I think is, you know, just whether you're in samsara or not, I mean, the universe supports. You know, you get what you need when you're ready for it. Mm-hmm. You know, and for the mumukshutvam also, in terms of coming to this knowledge, that mumukshutvam is necessary. Mm-hmm. Mumukshutvam that will change into jignasa, really. The mumukshutvam is a real desire for liberation, where the idea of the definition of liberation is correct. Like, what if you say, I really want to get liberated. I need to be able to astral travel. You know? Or, I really want to be able to, I want to be liberated. I must be able to sit in samadhi. You know, because that's my definition of liberation. So what is your definition of liberation? That's what you're seeking. What about when your definition of liberation matches, you know, what the Upanishad says liberation is? You know, then that teaching is relevant for you. Because usually the definition of liberation is still within duality. You know, let me have this and let me have that. Let me have this experience or that experience. Let me have these siddhis or these powers or these capacities. Let people respond to me as though I'm an enlightened being. You know, let me have that adoration. So that, you know... Let me be viewed as a liberated being, or whatever. It's, you know, so many different things.
I like the one you said about everything will be perfect, because I've had that. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, oh, this is perfect. Having that name, because I'm like, that's what everything. I was wondering if that comes from, like, being a child and an experience with the mother when everything was perfect, and then the memory of that and wanting that. You know what I mean?
Well, you could say that could be part of it. Also, even as you grow all the way through, you do have experiences where everything is perfect. Or I remember having experiences like, oh, this is how I'm supposed to be. Hang on to it. This is it. This is how I'm supposed to be. I should be like this all the time, you know? And then it would go away, and I remember feeling the kind of disappointment as that kind of sense of being who I really am dissipated, because really it was just my mind was, for whatever reason, enjoying a very beautiful shantavritti. You know, so that at that moment the creation was not impinging. I was awake, but the creation wasn't impinging upon, you know, my being. So I was kind of resplendent in that thought modification. I could feel, you know, this is who I am. Not in terms of being Brahman, in terms of just the being free, being whole, you know. And then I would not be able to hold on to that, nor know how I really got that. Mm. You know? But when you have that, you know this is, you know, who you are. The thing, the viveka that has to happen is that you have to recognize, it's not enough to recognize shantavrittis. We all can have shantavrittis, you know, these peaceful, quiet vrittis where you feel, that's when you feel all is well with me, and then it goes away. The discernment is to recognize the shanti of your own being that's there present to whatever type of thought modification you have. You could, these tumultuous and painful thought modifications really are born of your, are of samsara, of the way you're engaging in samsara. And then there's the other inner layer of complexes and things that we've had to deal with growing up, you know, so that there's internal pain. You have to learn how to work with all of that. But even whether it's internal pain or just pain out here, whatever, pain, whatever it is, there's my own presence that is free of that and present to it, and, you know, blesses it, really. It's in a, where I can be coming from my abiding in myself, recognizing myself in the midst of all of these changing experiences. That's important.
What?
And then we have to understand Ishwara. I have to do that.
Yeah. Why do they say that that grace is a factor? Because, you know what, grace is something that's bestowed on you. You don't create.
Well, Swamiji says that's why when we say Ishwara Anugraha, really is just your own karma. It's not Bhagavan saying, you know, I'm going to bless you, not you. I think I'll give you the blessing today. That's that Ishwara Anugraha, when you're, that grace of God is really just punya, the punya from your own karma.
Well, that's what they mean. It's
the punya from your own karma. Mm-hmm. That's why in that Viveka Chudamani, you know, that the very first verses say, you know, they talk about what, you know, the what tremendous punya, crores and crores of lifetimes of punya to be able to have get a healthy body, you know, that has viveka, that has a buddhi, that is capable of viveka, that then has the mamukshutvam. These are all more and more and more punya. And then you have the mamukshutvam, and then you meet a teacher who's a reliable teacher, not a charlatan. But then you get a teacher, you know, and then you have a mind that can understand this knowledge. This is more and more and more punya. It goes on and on, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's what they mean by the Ishwara Anugraha. Mm. Because the self is always there, whether the mind is in pain or the mind is free, it's the same self, it's the same. You know, and so, but as you start understanding that also all of the experiences that are taking place are really karma, they all exist within Ishwara's order. So that becomes all very important in understanding this teaching. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're a jiva in an inert creation trying to carve your way through and not understanding, not having any way to hold the different types of experiences and hardships that come your way. Life is very challenging, you know, it's for everybody. To see if anybody here hasn't had a challenging life, you've had to go through a lot of different things that were not easy for you. Somebody can say, well, mine were harder. That's very relative. The experience on the outside can look harder or, you know, harder or softer or whatever. But what was it for you? How was it for you? Mm-hmm. I don't know anybody that's gotten off very lightly, actually. Mm-hmm. I see everybody has big things that they... very good things and big things that are not easy. The big things means not easy. Really not easy. You have to grow a lot and really work with, yeah, really work with it to become bigger than the experience. Challenging. And then there's just a nice day to day.
You stop. See you next week.